So, thanks for coming. Thanks for being a part of it. This morning we are kicking off our summer Sunday school, summer school curriculum, however you want to look at it, going back through church history and picking up where we left off. So last year we covered and spent some time in the first six centuries of church history, looking at the early church and a lot of the controversies and theological debates and how the church grew and blossomed and end up spreading across the Roman Empire. This summer, we're going to be looking at the Middle Ages. Yeah. Sorry. Pastor's wife causing a stir. So this summer, we're going to be looking at the Middle Ages. And so this morning, what I want to do is sort of recap just a little bit of where we left off last time and then sort of introduce you to the Middle Ages and the factors that came in. Like, no one woke up one morning and was like, hey, today the Middle Ages begin. The Middle Ages is simply a term that historians use to refer to that period between the early church and the Reformation. And so everything that happens in between. So from about the 7th century to about the 15th century, where the church and the state have this unholy union, which we'll get to. You've got the several other features and factors that rise. But let's start with where we left off. So the first six centuries, give me some things that you remember that stood out to you from the first six centuries. I realize it was a long time ago, but help me out. Anything at all you remember? What about Constantine? Yeah, so Constantine was the first emperor of the Roman Empire who became a Christian and then made Christianity the state religion, and it became this statewide, empire-wide faith. Yeah, it's good. What were the theological issues surrounding the church? What was the church wrestling through primarily?
Whether Jesus was holy man or divine.
Yes. And so that's what, you had all these church councils spread out over 600-700 years, and they all focused on the same question. Is Jesus fully God and fully man? Is he part man, part God? How does this work? And so for 600 years, the church is embroiled in this ongoing debate. And you've got councils of Nicaea and Constantinople and Ephesus and Chalcedon, and they all revolved around the person of Christ. Who is he? And then, where we left off, at the end of the 6th century, beginning of the 7th century, you had this big debate that led into the Council of Chalcedon between the Monophysites and the Diophysites and the Nestorians. And it was still about this, how many natures does Christ have? Does he have a human nature and a divine nature? Does he just have one nature that consists of both? How does it work? And so you had one group in particular called the Monophysites, and we'll touch on them briefly in just a minute. But this ongoing debate between the Monophysites and the Chalcedonians, Monophysites, mono meaning one, physis meaning nature, so Monophysites believed that Christ had one nature, not two. The Chalcedonian Creed stated that Christ had two natures. He was both God and man. And so there's this ongoing debate, but for the next, and this debate lasts for 200 years. But at the start of the Middle Ages, the Monophysites get dominated by another faith that we'll talk about in a minute, and they sort of disappear. And so the debate ends. And so now, with all the debates ending over the person of Christ, the church now turns to other issues. And we'll come to that this semester? Summer? the other thing that happened as we ended our last study was you had this fraying relationship between the East and the West. So in the East you had Rome, you had the Roman Empire, in the West you had the Byzantine Empire. And what happens is this, you've got the Pope in Rome and you've got the Patriarch in Byzantine or Constantinople, and they're at odds with one another. Which one of these persons, which one of these offices truly leads the church? And which one, if the Pope says one thing and the Patriarch of Constantinople says another, who's right? Who should the church listen to? And what we'll see is this fraying relationship is actually going to come to a head in the East-West Schism in the 1032, 1040, somewhere in there. And it's going to divide. and you're going to have the Eastern Church and the Western Church. And so you have a big split coming. So that's where we kind of left off. Now let's introduce the Middle Ages. So, Rome has fallen, where we left off. The Goths and the Visigoths and the Huns and the Vandals invaded from the north. They come in and they burn Rome and they take over the entire Western kingdom. And so what they do is they divide the land and they divide it. So you've got Visigoths and you've got Franks and you've got Vandals and you've got Otters and Burgundians and Ostrogoths and Alamans and the fragmented British kingdoms with the Angles and Saxons and Jutes. And so the Roman Empire has been divided into all these different communities and tribes and many nations. And so as we come into the Middle Ages, there's three factors that sort of define and set the tone for what's coming. The first is the birth of the Frankish dynasty. So you got the Franks here. The Franks become French. Not German. The Franks become the French. Yes, the Germans have Frankenfurters, but the Franks didn't create the Frankenfurter. So the Franks become the French. And the Franks create this long-lasting dynasty, which we'll come to and spend a little bit more time in next week about this. But this is a key component of the Middle Ages. When Roman Empire falls and splits into all these miniature kingdoms, one thing that we know about the political spectrum at any point in time is that nature abhors a vacuum. And what I mean by that is if there's a gap in power, and if there's no consolidating power, if the seat of authority is empty, someone will fill it. Because nature hates a vacuum. Nature hates an empty space. And so what you have with all these little mini kingdoms is a vacuum. Who controls this area? And the Franks step up to the plate and they fill it. And they create what we'll look at next week, the Holy Roman Empire, which is different from the Roman Empire of old. And so you have this vacuum, but the Franks take over, and we'll talk about more next week. Next week, our focus is going to be on Charlemagne, the first emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. The second key feature that led into the Middle Ages was the end of the Monophysite controversy. So the Monophysites primarily existed. So again, these are the people that believed Christ had one nature, not two. And they primarily existed in Syria and Egypt. They were located here almost exclusively. And so when Chalcedon and all these other councils agreed that Christ has two natures, well, the Syrians and Egyptians are so far removed, they say, we don't care what you say, we're going to believe what we want to believe. And you can just leave us alone. And after years and years of emperors and Constantinople and Byzantine trying to force and enforce this theology on the Syrians and Egyptians, they said, we're ready for somebody else. And so what actually happens is that this debate becomes so intense that Persia invades. And they attack Byzantine and they come in here and they conquer this, they conquer this, and they conquer this. Now imagine this, as a Christian, living in a Christian empire, being conquered by a non-Christian empire, and Christians rejoicing over it. Because that's what the Syrians and Egyptians did. They rejoiced when the Persians came in. They said, finally, someone's going to free us from those ridiculous people in Constantinople who tell us what to believe. And so they rejoice over it. But essentially, the third factor, which we'll get to in just a second, puts an end to the Monophysite controversy. Because the Syrians and the Egyptians get conquered again, and they get silenced. And they're no longer part of the debate because they're no longer part of the church, and they're no longer part of the empire. They are removed completely. And so the controversy ends, which brings us to the third key event of the Middle Ages. And it's by far, I think, one of the biggest. And so this morning, I want to spend the rest of our time on this event, on this feature. Look how it affects the entirety of the Middle Ages, but not come back to it except in bits and pieces along the way. So any ideas on what the third feature of the Middle Ages would be? Any guesses? Islam. Thank you. And so Islam begins to rise in the 7th century. For 600 years, Christianity was the single most dominant faith throughout this region. No competitors. The only competitors, the only outsiders were pagans, which were primarily exist in just little tribes spread out throughout the world. They weren't a threat. And then in 632, Muhammad comes to power and starts this new faith. And so let me give you a brief overview of Islam, how it started, how it spread, and show you how it impacts the church for the next 1,000 years. So, who's the founder of Islam? Muhammad. And so Muhammad was born in around 570-ish, 570, 571, 572, in the Arabian Peninsula. So he is here. And he is born to a wealthy family, but his dad dies before he's born. His mom dies when he's six. And so he is then sent to live with his uncle, who is not wealthy. And Muhammad grows up working as a shepherd. At 25 years old, he marries a 40-year-old woman, a wealthy widow named Khadijah, and they have 6 children together. Now, during his time in Arabia, he encounters many different faiths and religions. Arabia is sort of this hodgepodge of pagan beliefs. You've got different tribes that believe different things. They worship different gods and have different practices. And there's just sort of this melding of idolatry, worship, God worshipers, but nothing really Christian, nothing really Jewish. It's just kind of there. And so he, as he's exploring and trying to figure out what he believes, he knows he interacts with Jews and Christians in the area, and he engages with them in theological conversations, but he's not satisfied to really grab hold of any of the things that are existing around him in his world. He's dissatisfied with the Arab faiths. He doesn't see them as really grasping anything of value. He couldn't worship Jesus because, in his words, the Trinity was a problem. Trinity was not monotheism, it was tritheism. Christians, in his mind, didn't believe in one God, they believed in three. And Judaism didn't really connect to really anyone that wasn't ethnically Jewish. And so Muhammad just sort of settles into this mindset that I'm going to worship the one true creator God, but without becoming Jewish or Christian. And in the year 610, while he's meditating in a cave, which I guess is something that people did back then, he comes home after meditating in a cave, and he comes and tells his wife, "I saw a vision. The angel Gabriel appeared to me, and I don't know what to do with it." And he's so paranoid and afraid of what happens that he flees the cave and he runs home because he thinks he's hallucinating. And he tells his wife, "I think I'm going crazy." And his wife Khadijah says, "God would never deceive such a good man as you. Go back and listen." And so he goes back. And this angel Gabriel appears and begins telling him truths about Allah, which Allah just means God in Arabic. And so he begins calling himself, after this vision, he begins calling himself the true prophet of God. And the interesting thing about it is he connects Jesus as his forerunner. So in Muhammad's view, Jesus was also a prophet of God who sort of paved the way for Muhammad to then walk. He affirmed Jesus' virgin birth. He said, yes, Jesus was born of a virgin. He affirmed that Jesus did miracles. He even affirmed that Jesus was sinless. But he refused to believe that Jesus was crucified. Because he, in his mind, in his view, God would never allow his prophets to be treated so shamefully. And so he said, "I believe in all the things that the Christians teach about Jesus except the crucifixion. God would never allow that to happen." And so he begins to gather followers. And he begins these conversions at home with his wife and his children. And then it goes to his extended family members, building this new faith on the 5 pillars of Islam. Anybody want to take a guess at one of the 5, or give me some thoughts? Do you know the 5 pillars? Yeah. Give me one of them. Yes. Yes. You're good. So there's praying. Praying 5 times a day and facing Mecca. Wherever you are in the world, you point your face, you point your body to the east towards Mecca, and you bow down and you pray. There's also fasting. They fast during Ramadan. Ramadan's one of the 5 pillars of the faith. There's a pilgrimage to Mecca. So a good Muslim, at least once in his life, needs to travel, no matter where he lives, no matter where he's from, needs to travel at least once in his life to Mecca, which is here. Because there in Mecca is a big shrine and a big holy, it's the holiest place in Islam. We'll come to that in just a moment. So there's fasting, there's a pilgrimage, there's prayer, there's two more, there's the charity, good Muslims give money to the poor, and then the last one is the confession of faith, the shahada. It says, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. These are the five pillars that he builds his faith on. Every Muslim must do these five things. But there's another basic tenet that is not one of the five pillars, though we Westerners often throw it in there as one of them. Any guesses? Jihad. What does jihad mean? Holy war. Wrong. What?
Kill the infidels.
Kill the infidels. Wrong. So jihad literally means struggle. We translate it as holy war because that's how we see it played out. But the struggle of jihad is actually, it refers both to a personal struggle to obey Allah and the struggle to spread Islam in the world, which is where we get the holy war, because Islam is spread by preaching, by writing, by diplomacy, and warfare. And so we often associate jihad with that last one. It's spread by the sword, which is true. Now, Islam spreads, and Muhammad begins here in Mecca. And in Mecca, as he's converting his family members, as he's converting his friends, there's a problem. Because his new faith puts a hit on the local economy of idols and idolatry. And so all the wealthy Arab merchants that are making their living off of selling pagan beliefs don't like this new guy. He's taking away all of our followers, and if you take away all of our followers, you take away all of our money. And so they run him out of town. And so he flees from Mecca, and he comes up north to Medina. And in Medina, his followers in Medina explode. I mean, within just a matter of months, maybe a year, the entire city and the local areas around it are all Islamic. They all follow Muhammad. And so after spending time building his following in Medina, Muhammad gathers an army of 10,000 Islamic soldiers, and they march to Mecca, and they take over the city. They slaughter anyone who opposes them. Anyone who refuses to convert to Islam, you die. Those that do agree to convert are allowed to live. But Mecca is now an Islamic city, and it belongs to the nation of Islam, to Muhammad. There in Mecca, he destroys all the pagan faiths. He removes their idols. He burns them all. And the offer to the people living there is simple. Become a Muslim or die. And then there in Mecca, they build a new shrine called the Kaaba, which still stands today. Yeah.
What country is that today?
Today, this would be... Any ideas? I'm not good at geography.
Saudi Arabia.
Thank you. So you've got here in the Arabian Peninsula, you've got Saudi Arabia, you've got Oman, you've got Yemen, you've got all these. I mean, Israel's right here. So it's a very contested area even today. But there in Mecca, he builds this shrine called the Kaaba. It's still standing today. This is why the pilgrimage to Mecca matters so much. Good Muslims, at least once in their life, go to this shrine and worship. Questions so far? Yeah.
So you said that the only thing that they disagreed with was the crucifixion. Did they believe in the resurrection?
No, because Jesus was never crucified. Oh. So how do you raise from the dead if you're never dead? Oh. It's a good question.
So how did they believe he died?
He just died in his old age.
Oh.
Yeah, 33. Which, hey, at the time, 33 could have been an old man. So what happens as a result of this new conquering and new faith is that by conquering Medina and conquering Mecca and establishing this Islamic rule, Muhammad now rises to power. And where you have previously an Arabian Peninsula that had been intensely divided culturally, ethnically, religiously, Islam offers unity. And it brings all of these Arabian tribes together under one faith and under one ruler. And it unites them. Their soldiers, their army that Muhammad begins to build up and muster, their soldiers are unlike anything the world's ever seen. Their soldiers are fierce, they're brave, and they're completely sober, which was unique during the time. Islam forbids the consumption of alcohol. And so their soldiers aren't heading into the battlefield drunk like the rest of the world. They're going in sober. And not only sober, but zealous. Because of their faith, they had no fear of death. Dying in the battle was a way to honor and serve Allah. And so within 100 years, after he takes Mecca, within 100 years, which is not a long time, it takes the church 400 or 500 years to spread. It takes Islam 100. Within 100 years, Islamic forces had created this vast Islamic empire stretching all the way from India to Spain. 100 years. They sweep over Arabia like a desert storm. They swallow up half of the Byzantine Empire. Because remember, this belongs. This right here. He takes this. He takes this. He takes this. They take this. All of it. They eradicate the Persian Empire completely. So there's an interesting story where basically, again, nature abhors a vacuum. So Persia attacks and they take over part of this area from the Byzantines. Well, the Byzantine Empire doesn't like that. What emperor would? And so they send forces and they attack. And they not only drive the Persians back, but they take them all the way in to their capital city. But because it's so far away and they don't have the soldier or the manpower to occupy the place, after destroying it, they withdraw. Which leaves a vacuum, which Muhammad and his people fill and take over. Now, one of the things that we have to consider as we understand how Islam impacts and impacted the church, these major cities of the first 600, 700 years of the church, Jerusalem, Antioch, Alexandria, Damascus, These are major cities for the Christian faith. Major cities where theology not only began, but was built up and established and worked out. Churches that sent missionaries around the world came from here. And now it's Islamic. And it's taken over and it's dominated and it's ruled and it's subjected to Islamic rulers. All of these cities now find themselves under the rule of a foreign faith and a hostile faith at that. So what happens to the Christians and churches that are here? What do? They don't. Now, there's a caveat to this and how this worked out in each century and each decade, because a lot of this depended on who was ruling the Islamic Empire at the time. So Islamic Empire were ruled by caliphs, these sort of Arabian emperors. They believed that they were direct descendants of Muhammad and they ruled in his name. They traced the bloodline down and they said, we're Muhammad's great, 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 great grandson, so we're the new king. But then you also had, because it's such a vast space, they divided it, much like the Romans did, into these local provinces, or they called them emirates. And the emirates were ruled by local governors or emirs. Now, for the most part, all Arabs were expected to be Islam by force if necessary. So if you were Arabian or of Arabian descent, you became Muslim no matter what. And if you didn't, you died. Non-Arabs, so if you lived in this area and you were not Arabian, you were not forced into Islam. For example, when Islam conquers Persia, Persia's not Arabian, but they're also not Islamic. They're Zoroastrian. And so when Islam comes into Persia and conquers the area and fills the space, they do not force all of their subjects to become Muslim. they allow them to continue their faith in their own way as long as they submit to the Islamic rule. Now, Jews and Christians in this area held a sort of a favored status. They weren't considered the same level as the pagan faiths. They were sort of elevated a little bit. And the only reason they were elevated and given this favored status is because Muhammad recognized them as worshiping the same God as they did. They said, "We worship the same God, so we're going to give you some freedom here, but just a little bit." Because Muhammad also believed that while they were worshiping the one true God, he also believed that they had corrupted the truth of the one true God's revelations to them. So they were not forced to convert. They were allowed to continue in worship, to worship their God in their own respective ways. However, there were some very serious disadvantages placed on Christians in this area. So, a couple things. One, Christians were forced to live in segregated communities, and they were viewed as second-class citizens, which means that some of their rights that everyone else in the empire in the area got, Christians didn't necessarily have access to. They were viewed as sort of lower. And having forced themselves into these segregated communities, they were assigned a bishop that I think Islam sort of used the church's language and assigned a bishop, an overseer over them. And that bishop was politically responsible for anything that a Christian did under his watch. So if a Christian broke the law in any way, it was the bishop who was punished. So you kind of not only segregate them and force them into these small communities, but you also put all the blame on one person and give him total control and total responsibility for anything that happens in his community. Christians also paid a heavy poll tax. What's a poll tax? Not for elections. No, you're good. I've got some here. I was looking for my coffee. Any ideas? So a poll tax is different from an income tax and it's different from a property tax. A poll tax has nothing to do with what you own or how much you make. A poll tax simply says, do you live here? Then pay a tax. And it was the same tax for every person. No matter what you made, no matter how much property you owned or didn't own, every single individual from birth to death paid the same tax. But only Christians paid it. Only Christians were responsible for paying it. And it was heavy. Christians also had to wear distinctive clothing. So if you're a Christian and you're walking through the market, people can look at you by what you're wearing and say, oh, you're a Christian. That reminds you of any more recent regimes? Hitler. Christians were forbidden to own or use swords or horses. Creates a problem if you're a farmer. Christians were not allowed any public processions carrying crosses or icons. Not allowed. Christians also were not allowed to ring bells or beat drums to signify the beginning of a worship service. Marriage between a Christian and a Muslim was strictly forbidden, resulting in death if found out. And the most damaging feature, the most damaging disadvantage placed on Christians in this time was that Christians were not allowed under any circumstance to evangelize. If you were caught trying to spread your faith in any way, shape, or form, you were immediately killed. Immediately. And conversion from Islam to Christianity was punishable by death. So what's the church to do? You have churches that and Christians that have been these pillars of communities of the faith for hundreds of years. And now they are isolated, they are cut off, and they are forced to stay within these walls, and they are not allowed to spread anything. So what do you think happens? What's that? Some of them do. And if they don't convert, the church dies off. Because the Christians remain Christians, but they grow old, they die, or they die under persecution, and the church just sort of crumbles. Because they can't grow. They can't spread. They can't evangelize. They can't teach. They can't do anything. And so the church dies. here. With a few exceptions. So one of the things that I'm going to have you or encourage you to read this week is some writings by a guy named John of Damascus. So John lived here. The Catholic Church calls him a saint for probably good reasons. He was a prominent Christian voice in a Muslim-dominated world. John was a guy who advocated for apologetics, which is defending the Christian faith to other faiths. He advocated, he was an advocate, a political advocate for Christian communities to Islamic caliphates and emirs, trying to get them better protection, better care, better health, all of it. John was a fantastic advocate for the church in an Islamic country. But there's other things that John of Damascus didn't really, we don't really agree with him on completely, but we'll get to that later. So he writes several things during his life. And one of the things that he writes is called A Dialogue Between a Christian and a Muslim. Or it might, if you find it online, it might say A Dialogue Between a Christian and a Saracen, which is what they called Muslims at the time. And what he does in this writing is he creates a fictional dialogue where a Muslim, an imaginary Christian, and an imaginary Muslim are talking together about their faiths. And they're engaging with one another. They're talking about what they believe, what they believe. And John writes this as an apologetics. What he's doing is he's equipping the church and saying, this is how you engage the Muslims in your community. This is how you engage the Muslims next door. This is how you engage your neighborhood in the faith, and how you can question what they believe and display what you believe and not be so aggressive or timid and finding that balance. Other questions? So let me ask a few. You have, as Islam rises, and not only rises but begins conquering what used to be part of Christendom, how do you think the church responds? So that not the church here, but the church here, where it's still Christian. Crusades. So what you have, and this is by no means to justify the Crusades, but what the church looks at and what the state looks at, because again, as we'll see, church and state are very closely married together. And so what you have as a foreign faith begins to rise, and not only begins to rise, but begins to rise wielding the sword, you have the church begin looking at this and saying, this is not simply a political battle. This is not simply a battle of kingdoms. This is a cosmic battle of good versus evil. This is a cosmic battle of God versus Satan. And Satan's picking up the sword. So we better pick it up too. And the church does, and the church and the state together do all kinds of horrible things. All because they had a sword, we should get one too. Questions? Yep.
So is Allah and the Jehovah God the same?
The Jehovah guy.
Yeah.
Like Yahweh or like Jehovah's Witness guy?
So
your question is Allah the Father of Jesus? Is that a better way? Is that fair to, is that what you're asking? So Muslims think he is. Christians, we do not. And the whole basis for it is because the attributes that Muslims attribute to Allah do not line up with who the Bible tells us God is. So Muslim, one of the key components, and you'll see this in this John of Damascus dialogue between a Muslim and a Christian, is that Muslims believe that Allah is responsible for all things that happen. That Allah consists of both good and evil. That He does good and He does evil. That's a problem for us. That's not the same God. The God that we worship, the God, the Father of Christ, does not do evil. He uses evil. He even ordains evil. But He's not evil. There's nothing evil that He does. There's nothing evil that He... That there's no evil in him whatsoever. Yes.
And Muhammad definitely didn't believe in the triune God.
No, triune God's a polytheism. No way that can be true. Yep. Yes.
Of the many idols, I've heard Allah was one of the idols. He just said, we're going with this one, and this one's God, and no other can make it.
Yeah, there's some truth to that. I think that there, among the hodgepodge of idol worshippers, there were some, they just called them God worshippers. We see this in the New Testament, too. There are Gentiles who worship the God of Judaism without becoming Jewish. They believe that that's the God that's true. That's the creator God. And they worship that creator God without necessarily becoming Jewish. And so you had sort of these Arabs who believed that there is a one creator God, and they called him Allah because they spoke Arabic, and they worshiped him, but there was no really religion, formal religious system around it. It was.
They filled that void with Allah.
Yes. It's good. You had a question. Yes, so Islam is an Abrahamic faith, which is what Muhammad attests to, and Christians still attest to this, meaning that there are three Abrahamic faiths, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And what I mean by Abrahamic is those faiths that can trace back to Abraham. Abraham had two sons, Isaac and Ishmael. Ishmael was not the son of promise. Isaac was. And so when God in Genesis cast out Ishmael and Hagar, he makes a promise that Ishmael will not be cut off, that his people will survive and thrive, but that they will never be part of the promise. They will never be part of the covenant. God still blesses them, but blesses from a distance. And so Muhammad takes this connection to Ishmael and elevates it and says, we're the followers of Ishmael. We're the descendants of Ishmael. We follow the same God. But now, just as God promised, there's conflict. And so Muslims still remain on the outside. But this growth and this prosperity that we see taking place, I mean, can we not say that it's a blessing from, like, no one prospers unless God makes them prosper. And so for one reason or another, things that we may or may not understand, God allows and ordains Islam to prosper and to grow and to flourish. But they're still not part of the covenant. And they're still not part of the promise. It's a good question. Others? Yep.
This is just kind of a follow-up to that. Would you say, like, is that the primary reason why Muhammad doesn't align more with Judaism? In terms of, because there's disagreement from his perspective as well as from the Jewish faith about the Trinity and about
Yeah.
Like, so is that dynamic of the traditional descendants, like, the reason why he doesn't align with them? I think there's some other, like, offense as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're simplifying things, is that, like, yeah, I think that's probably the easiest answer, right? I mean, when you consider Judaism as a religion, right, Judaism is really only for Jewish people. It's not really a proselytizing faith. It's, you give birth to Jews, and then they give birth to Jews, and then they give birth to Jews. Like, it's not really even in the Old Testament, you had a court of the Gentiles, where Gentiles could come and worship God with the Jewish people, but they weren't Jewish. And Muhammad and Islam and Muslims and Arabs aren't Jewish. And so this is sort of, again, oversimplifying this, but Islam is sort of a way for non-Jewish Jews, descendants of Abraham, to worship the God of Abraham without becoming Jewish. But as we see in their theology, it's not the same God. It's a false God. Other questions? Got time for a couple more? All right, so I looked for it a little bit this week. It's hard to find, but I will try to find a version of John of Damascus's dialogue between a Christian and a Saracen. If I can't find it, I'll type it up and I'll put it on the church Facebook page. Read over it this week. I think it's a good read. It's a great understanding, a great way for us to consider how do we engage with the theology of Islam as Christians, even today. How do we engage with Muslims? How do we talk to them? How do we confront errant beliefs without being confrontational? And so it's a great apologetics text in that matter. Next week, we're going to talk about the rise of Charlemagne. And there's a great story of how he comes to power and everything else. Long story short, Charlemagne had no intent of ever becoming emperor. But he was Catholic. And so he travels from the Frankish kingdom and he comes down to Rome to take communion and to be a part of worship in front of the Pope. And so he comes up to the altar to receive communion and he bends down on the altar to pray and the Pope whips out a crown and goes, "Emperor!" And Charlemagne goes, what? But we'll get there. We'll talk about that next week. Yeah.